Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is February 21st, 2025, and this is episode 503. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York. You're listening to Radio Warner. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warner. I'm on the line with the Warnerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in Italy. John, how you doing?
I'm fine, but there was just some sad news relating to the Warnerd group. I just heard from Amelia Lise that the guy who calls himself Sornala, that is Alan Ross backwards, who I presume is named Alan Ross, died recently, died of a heart attack, and died a few weeks after his wife died. And that's very sad because I met him in the London meetup at the Old White Bear or Bean, I forget what it is. And he was a great guy. He actually knew 20th century poetry, and he knew a wide range of contemporary music. In fact, he was one of the few, the proud, the Fall scholars. And he also had a really magnificent mustache that could have graced a sergeant major in the old days. So sad news.
Yeah, that is sad. The Radio Warner community, it has to be said again, we see this through the Facebook community and through personal meetups. They're amazing people. There are a lot of smart people out there. Sadly, there are not a lot of smart people running things in this world. No. They tend to not want to bother with the type of people who do run things. And that leads us to the subject of today's episode, which is... Well, we're coming up on the third anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That was February 24th, 2022. And we'll have a lot to say about all of that. So today what we want to do is maybe not so much go over, you know, every phase of the war. Again, we've talked about the war so much on the show since it started. But this year, so much of the war is about domestic American politics, and I would argue it always was about domestic American politics. I think in a way it's important to go back again through the record of how this war, everything that led up to this war, and what this war has meant to the metropole, to Washington and to Brussels and to the Trump administration and to MAGA, to see it that way, because the reaction from the sort of the media political establishment in NATO countries has been absolute sort of shock and paralysis and hysteria. Not without, you know, I mean, they have some cause for that, but what they don't have cause for is to not understand why. And they're just very deliberately, like, the only things that come into their head are Russian disinformation, sorcery, hex has been cast on Trump again and all these people.
There was a long post on my Facebook page today mentioning that we've talked on two consecutive shows about why it would seem that Zelensky's people seem to side strongly, if not with Biden, then against the Trump regime. And somebody said, of course they'll do that. That's their right. But it just didn't seem wise. And it seemed a lot wiser to at least pretend to neutrality. So, yeah, if we can talk about how they got into this mess, then that would be illuminating, I think.
I mean, of course, it's their right to do anything that they can or can't get away with, right? I mean, yeah, but what we what we've all been pretending all along is that Ukraine has this enormous agency, which we are just merely sympathetic bystanders to, rather than America has nearly all agency in everything here and in everything that goes on in the West and in Ukraine. And that has been painful for those people to, well, particularly the, you know, let's call them, I don't know, the political media elites in Europe and in the U.S. to grasp. And so real quickly, I just want to say this, quick sort of update on where the actual war is. I mean, it's still a slow, grinding war, but Russia has been making the same steady, grinding, attritional advances. Just in January, last month, Ukraine lost Kurakhove, a very strategic town in sort of more south, going to southwest Donetsk Oblast. They lost Tverdyetsk, the last of the great fortress cities that had been fortified from 2014 through 22. It finally fell in January. Velika Novosilka, I've talked about. That was a big loss. Another one of these key towns way in the south of Donetsk. There's not a lot. I mean, it's one area they've been advancing a little faster is once they move beyond Velika Novosilka. Chesiv Yar apparently has, this is like one of the longest battles. I mean, it's literally, 6-7 miles west of Bakhmut, which was taken back in 2023. Here we are in 2025, and they moved, 7-8 miles, taking most now of Chesiv Yar. But this is, aside from like Tverdyetsk, a fortress town, Chesiv Yar has been one of the most difficult and most strategic towns, more in the sort of getting up towards the northern part of the Donetsk Oblast. It is a strategic high point, the highest point. And down from there, they have a kind of a straight path, depending on how slow or fast they want to go, the Russians, to the last large cities in the Donbass, which would be Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. So losing Chesiv Yar is another big deal. Just this month, they've lost Konstantinopol, Andriivka. They've lost control over the coking coal mines just to the west of Pokrovsk.
To the west of Pokrovsk. So yeah. They've taken Pokrovsk,
well,
then?
It's weird when you look at it on a map. No, it's sort of like southwest of Pokrovsk, I guess you would say. The thing that's important about Pokrovsk is there are so many key major roads. It is, as they say, a logistical hub for the Donetsk region that go through Pokrovsk. And at this point, Pokrovsk is becoming cut off. I mean, the Russian strategy since Bakhmut and since Bakhmut, really, has been usually not to go head on into whatever strategic town they want to take, but to always try and envelop them and cut off their lines of communication and then strangle them. And
I have to point out it's that beautiful Mao slogan that Short quotes in his book. Like Mao said, he learned everything about strategy or tactics anyway from a bandit chief he knew, and it was circle around, circle around, circle around.
Mm. Yeah, and one reason why it keeps working is because the new commander-in-chief who was installed by Zelensky is just a loyalist. And I think by now most people agree he's awful. And a lot of people knew he was awful when Zelensky installed him a year ago. Everybody knew he was getting rid of the old guy, Zaluzhny, because Zaluzhny was a political threat, and installing the new guy, the lousy but loyal commander-in-chief, Siersky, because he's a loyalist and he's so hated by his own troops that he poses no threat to Zelensky. And, I mean, really, that's kind of... And one thing Siersky does, and he's shown this over and over, every battle, going back to when he first took over during the Battle of Avdiivka a year ago, is he never orders orderly retreats that can save forces.
Yeah.
the way that the Ukrainians command treats its grunts is, imagine the worst cliche, some of which are true, about how Russian commanders don't, you know, as they say, they don't care about life. They don't care about their conscripts. I'm not sure that's really true. That definitely used to be true about Russian commanders. Like in the first Chechen War, it was grotesque. I'm not sure how, I don't think that that's very true though in this war, certainly not since some of the disasters of the opening months. Mm. And so Sirski, like you know over and over, and it's like nothing changes. Every time you come up to a city, the Russians are going to slowly envelop it, take road by road entrance, exit by road entrance, exit, and the Ukrainians will not retreat in time, over and over.
Yeah, in that situation, I imagine that if you're in the Ukrainian trenches facing front, you're going to start listening very nervously for the sound of armored vehicles moving behind you, moving around behind you.
Or you're just going to skedaddle long before that happens. I mean, you know, we're talking about, I think, officially recognized at least 80,000 desertions. But I think the real figure is something like 220,000. That's massive. And so they have these, you know, incredible personnel problems because, I mean, even the Kyiv Independent, which is one of these USAID funded or US Embassy funded, has some good reporting in it, though, I would say. They've had some harrowing articles about how commanders leave their troops behind, throw them to the dogs, don't take out the wounded. And everybody knows it. Like when you read, you know, events in Ukraine, who basically is calling Ukrainian media and Ukrainian social media and how they talk about the war to themselves, they all know that how profoundly corrupt and cruel the war is to in a sort of hierarchical way, and how it's just everything they said about the Russians, they're doing to themselves. Right. Of course, this is one of the stories that the Western media has very deliberately suppressed from us. We can't know that. The Ukrainians know it. We can't know that because their job, the media has seen its job from the beginning, is to be morale boosters in the home countries so that aid keeps flowing. And so even when they do report on morale issues, they don't get deep down into just how savage it is compared to what the Ukrainians themselves report on what's going on.
What about the Trump administration's fund cutoff to all these sources that have supposedly been built up by USAID and other funds?
Well, one thing I could tell you is on social media, you don't see the NAFO troll army as much as you used to.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen them much at all.
Yeah. And they're not going to get money. They haven't moved on to something else yet. They're maybe looking for other sources of money. They're in deep shit. You know, what else? Because they are in deep shit. The entire industry is built on getting money from the U.S. and then pushing narratives that are in their interest and in the America's interest, and so their interests are mutual because that's where the paycheck comes from, and that has been the source of so much kind of Ukrainian official media hawkishness and suppressing voices, Ukrainian voices, and they are many, but they've just been suppressed, Ukrainian voices who want this war to end, who want a ceasefire, who have not, you know, wanted to keep fighting to the last Ukrainian. Without that money, it's going to be harder to suppress that. We're going to see a shit show. And I'm going to talk more about that as we get on. But I think potentially bigger crisis coming up is that the U.S., Trump has been talking about cutting off military aid to Ukraine. And there's a question about whether a recent package, I think it was like $400 million or something, was released or not released. This is like in the last week. But really, then the question is, can the Ukraine military survive without U.S. backing? And I don't, we could talk about that a little bit now and maybe again later, but I mean, I would say no. I've seen the argument that they can, and you know, maybe if the U.S. hadn't been bankrolling them and cheering them on with everything they had for the last 3 years, they might have been able, they would have been able to survive because they'd already have learned how to fight this war without that support.
Well, I suppose if the German army drove all its vehicles eastward and then got out and said, here you go, good luck, they could survive for a while.
Maybe, but I think, you know, I don't know how much the Germans have left. I don't know how much equipment most of these European countries even have left. Not a lot. I think it's more like, I guess I'm more talking about more sort of insurgency level warfare, a different kind of war. But what I have seen sort of people in the sort of pro-Ukraine corner, including, you know, Ukrainians, Russians, who are very against the Russians and pro-Ukraine, saying that, no, Ukraine can survive because drone warfare. They're very good at drone warfare, and they have been since the beginning. It's not like they just came up with some new invention. It keeps ramping up every year. Drones are very effective. They are like what machine guns maybe were in the, you know, for trench warfare in World War I. They do make it hard to advance. The Russians have, you know, come up with all sorts of tactics to combat that, like small units on motorcycles and scooters and, you know, little dune buggies and whatever else that have had some success. This idea that, again, the Wunderwaffen will save them is, this is not, I mean, hardware, of course, matters a lot, but Ukraine's problem is manpower, and the manpower problem is corruption, low morale, and ultimately it's a political problem where you have just a rapacious and very atomized, you know, a rapacious political class, a rapacious system, and a very atomized public, which is not, doesn't get much from the country except now forced mobilization and death or losing their limbs. So their problems are very deep at this point. I don't think like more drones is what's going to save them, but you know, wars can be unpredictable. A little more about January, early February. Yeah, so the coking coal mines, these are, again, really key to what's left of Ukrainian industry because the coking coal here is used for 90% of what's left of Ukraine's metallurgical industry, which is a big part of their export earnings. So without coking coal, like they'll have to basically import from the EU somewhere, and it'll be far more expensive to keep that industry going, which means that they're not going to make much money, if at all, on those exports. And they're about to lose, I think, Shevchenko in the Shevchenko area near Velika Novosilka. The Russians are a few miles away from, I think, the largest lithium deposit in Ukraine and one of the largest in Europe. Lithium, of course, powers Elon Musk's cars and all sorts of batteries. So that is one problem. Also, you know, Russia has expanded beachheads to the west bank of the Oskol River around Kupiansk. That's up north. That's a problem. Again, the Russians don't seem to be wanting to storm Kupiansk itself, but they're doing that slow strangulation of Kupiansk. The war is at that, I mean, I think it was The Economist had a headline a couple of weeks ago about Ukraine's crumbling front lines. So that's out there, like it's well known. But again, the far bigger problem is the Trump administration and the political shifts that are going on in the West right now, it's a big problem. And, you know, again, we've talked about this in the last couple episodes, Pete Hegseth's speech, you know, telling the Europeans that Ukraine is not coming into NATO. Like, he finally said out loud what no one could ever see out loud. I mean, it's the weirdest war. The war, again, it has to be said, sort of the basis for this war, I mean, unless you think Russia always wanted to, or Putin always wanted to reestablish the Soviet Union empire, and so he's Adolf Hitler. There's that crowd, and there's no talking to that crowd. So let's just say you guys enjoy yourself in your corner. You know, since 2007, when Putin has been warning the West not to bring Ukraine into NATO and Georgia, and that it considers it a red lines and a threat, the U.S., of course, and the EU have been trying to bring Ukraine in closer to NATO without actually putting Ukraine in NATO. And the reason is to tie Russia down, to subvert the Putin regime until a friendlier regime is put in, or to peel Ukraine away for good, one way or another. And, you know, in the lead up, in the year lead up to Russia's invasion, Russia wanted an explicit guarantee that Ukraine was not going to be invited into NATO, because when Biden took office, he was very publicly calling for bringing Ukraine closer to NATO, protecting Ukraine from Putin, who he called a thug and a dictator. And behind the scenes, there was a lot going on. And we didn't know about it until it was reported in our press, but obviously Russian intelligence did. One of the most sort of obvious examples of this is how, according to, you know, Washington Post and others, the CIA moved into Kyiv as soon as, it was right after the Maidan Revolution 2014, and basically recreated and launched the modern-day version of the Military Intelligence Bureau, the GUR, or HUR, since G is pronounced H-H in Ukrainian, led by Kirill Budzinov these days. And that's their baby. So, they, you know, Ukrainian military intelligence, which is responsible for a lot of their spectacular attacks, like, you know, the killing of Daria Dugina and some of those assassinations, the truck bombing, suicide bombing, using some poor hapless Armenian truck driver who didn't know, to blow up a section of the Crimean Bridge, probably involved in some way in the Nord Stream bombing, perhaps. The GUR also armed and trained that Russian neo-Nazi formation, the Volunteer Corps, led by White Rex and some other neo-Nazis that invaded Russia a couple times. That is all the CIA's baby, and that is from 8 years of work on top of, you know, U.S. and NATO training, aid, and so on. In the lead-up, you know, Putin wanted some explicit guarantees, and it, in a way, it was sort of calling. It put the Biden people and everybody in the EU in a bit of a bind, because they'd been coaxing, you know, Ukraine along all this time, putting Ukraine in danger, and if because Putin intimidated the West, Biden came out and said, I publicly state that I guarantee Ukraine won't be allowed in. Can you imagine, you know, that Biden would have been savaged, absolutely savaged. It would have,
no, that, yeah. one of the things that was clear after the election debacle is that the people around Biden were so focused on being a new version of the 20th century American elite, which had free rein to mess with the rest of the world and could more or less count on the home front being okay with whatever they wanted to do, that they were suddenly stunned at the fact that people really objected, much more than they ever allowed for, both to their adventures in Ukraine and their adventures in Gaza. Mm-hmm. They didn't seem to think that that was going to be a factor in the election.
Yeah. Actually, Jeffrey Sachs was speaking somewhere. So Jeffrey Sachs was the architect of shock therapy with Chubais and Yegor Gaidar. And then he got pushed out and sort of pushed out by kind of internal political spats back in the early mid-90s, replaced by other people aligned with Larry Summers. That's a whole nother story. And then since then, he's become a rather eloquent kind of insider-outsider critic of U.S. empire. And he's like one of these guys, though, that has inside access. So it's interesting always to listen to him. And he said that he called up Jake Sullivan, the Biden's national security advisor, and had a long talk with him in December of 2021, so 2 months before the invasion. And he said to Sullivan, like, don't let this invasion happen. Don't allow this war to happen. Why don't you come out and say that, you know, Ukraine's not going to be in NATO? And Sullivan said, but they're not going to be in NATO. We all know it. Like, we all talk about it behind the scenes. Of course they're not going to be in NATO, because that would mean war with Russia. And Sullivan said, Jeffrey Sachs said, then say it publicly so that we can forestall this, you know, a coming war. And Sullivan said, oh, they're not going to invade. But we can't say it publicly, because if we say it publicly, then we lose face. But everybody knows behind the scenes it's not going to happen. But we can't say it publicly. It's like the war broke out because of something that these guys couldn't say publicly. And they had no imagination to come up with other ways of forestalling this war. It's really incredible, and we'll get some more into that. But what I want to do, I'm going to start off with a little recent news, and then we're going to go backwards, because I think, as people have seen, you know, Hegseth and then the Defense Secretary Hegseth and Vice President J.D. Vance and then Trump himself, like, their rhetoric towards the EU and NATO partners, EU, and towards Ukraine sort of went from kind of harsh cold water to outright hostility, almost warlike, in a matter of a week. And through a source I have who knows firsthand through people about some of these meetings that went on in Europe with where Hegseth and Vance were, because I was asking around, like, this is, I mean, you see some of these responses, like Zelensky, after Trump's first sort of lashing out, Zelensky thinking, I know a smart way to respond to this. Tell Trump that he's a victim of Russian disinformation. Yeah. Like, dude, you have just conjured up all of Trump's vengeful bitterness from his first term. That's like the very last thing you would talk about.
Yeah, you're not going to have Biden's people supporting you when you do that. It's going to be Trump's people, and they don't like you anyway. So it's not too smart.
So what I was told was that, and I very much believe this, knowing Kaya Kallas, Kaya Kallas is one of the sources of, on a personal level, and, you know, remember, Trump particularly operates on a very personal level, for turning them really hostile. Kaya Kallas was the prime minister of Estonia. Among European leaders, even though Estonia is tiny, like, one of these ex-communist officials who are the most rabid anti-Russian, anti-communist figure. She came from a communist elite family in Estonia. Her father was a high-level apparatchik. She's on the extreme end. She, for example, is the only EU leader or any world leader I know of that openly aligned herself with NAFO. And NAFO is part of the problem with the Trump administration, too, by the way, that openly aligned with NAFO, that would, like, send in, you know, video messages about her support for NAFO when they'd have conferences, openly, like, went to funerals of, like, straight-up neo-Nazi guys, like Da Vinci, and I can't remember his name, from the Da Vinci Wolves, who died in Bakhmut. She went to his funeral, and he's just, I mean, you can look at his stuff. It's swastikas and black and red UPA flags and everything. So she's like on the extreme end. And when her political career was flagging in Estonia, she got rescued and bumped up to basically foreign minister for the EU. So she's a powerful player now, and she loves that. And this source said that she attacked Hegseth to his face personally, and called him and Trump appeasers, and like dug her finger into his face and yelled at
him. You're kidding. I'm trying to imagine this. One finger or all her fingers into his face?
Well, a pointy finger pointing at his face. It would be so much better if she actually dug that. I would almost respect that.
Yeah.
And pulled his face off like something from Evil Dead. My language is right. Pointing at him and scolding him. Like after his speech about how Ukraine's not going to be in NATO, and let's say the quiet part out loud, and the U.S. is not going to put peacekeepers into any, ceasefire role, and that Europe's going to have to do it. So Kallas, in a closed-door meeting, demanded to sit next to him, and then she started scolding him as an appeaser.
That is mighty bold when you're from Estonia.
Yeah.
It's like, wow. But then I've mentioned before, I knew people in Pleasant Hill who went to Estonian camp every summer. Yeah.
Wow.
And they were training to be patriots of the restored Estonian state. And they were very hardcore.
Yeah. She was described, I mean, I've seen her, and so this would fit with everything I've seen and read of her, but she was described as like the ultimate PMC, PMC ladder climber type, very overconfident, not a very pleasant person. So this got back to Trump, who exploded apparently. And they're all dealing with the fallout of this. Now, Trump's negative associations with and feelings towards Ukraine and the Ukraine leadership go back. And so I'm going to talk a bit about that as well. Because I think, going back to like how this war started, and of course, everybody rightly goes back to, the Maidan revolution / coup. It wasn't exactly a coup. It wasn't exactly a revolution. It was kind of some of both in 2014, because that's what upset the balance between sort of the more neutralist part of Ukraine that was called pro-Russian, but I would say is more like Russia-friendly, but not anti-West, at least didn't used to be, versus the pro-NATO Western Ukrainians. That sort of back and forth got ended with the Maidan Revolution, which it cannot be understated how much of a role U.S. aid and American aid and EU aid played in funding the groups that that launched that coup, that set Ukraine on a very, very anti-Russian path that led to, Crimea breaking away, the rebellions in the Donbas, in Odessa, in Kharkiv, and really just turned Ukraine into a different country since then. In fact, I think it was Victoria Nuland who was like handing out cookies during the Maidan Revolution and giving all of her support. I think it was her who said that the U.S. had invested $5 billion into Ukraine, which would have been basically from, the mid-90s to the early 2010s. So over a period of, 15 to 20 years, $5 billion. That means into Ukrainian, what they call civil society, but civil society is all geared towards moving Ukraine to the West and away from Russia. $5 billion in a country like Ukraine is a lot of money. I mean, just to give an example, so Ukraine's total GDP in 2013 was like $130 billion. And America's was like $17.5 trillion. So wow. If you just go on a GDP basis, it would be as if over 15 years, some foreign country invested, I mean, you could just add two zeros, $500 billion, half a trillion dollars into American civil society groups, you know, to push for something that would be what China would want or what Russia would want or something. It's a lot of money in a country that was already very weak, very broken, very corrupt. The leverage is insane. But what I would say is this, that left out of these narratives that is now very important and is actually central to the story is the overlap of Maidan and post-Maidan up to the war and Russiagate. Because what we're living through now is the blowback from Russiagate. The people who pushed Russiagate hard, and this were the institutions, the institutional media, the institutional establishment, political class, the cultural class, were pushing a xenophobic hoax that the president was literally controlled by Russia from 2015 or 16 through 2019, it got derailed by the Mueller report, which found no collusion, but nevertheless segued into the impeachment that was launched against the first impeachment against Trump a few months after the Mueller report kind of killed impeaching Trump for colluding with Russia. So they found another reason, and that reason was Ukraine. But going back again real quickly to Trump's personal experience with Ukraine and with Ukrainians. You know, Russiagate kind of starts with the Steele dossier by Christopher Steele, which is to dig up dirt compromise on Trump to demonstrate that he is aligned secretly with the Russians. At first, you know, people, I guess, kind of forget this. At very first, the Steele dossier was financed by Never Trumpers. During the Republican primaries 2015-16. And as soon as it looked like it was clear that Trump was going to become the GOP candidate, the Steele dossier book got picked up by the Hillary Clinton campaign and the DNC. And that whole sort of network wound up working with, you know, ultimately with the FBI, probably CIA.
Sorry, didn't the Steele dossier include reports that he had prostitutes pissing on the bed or something? Okay.
Yeah. The most memorable the most memorable part of it was the claim that Trump paid Russian prostitutes at a Marriott, I think it was, in downtown Moscow to pee on a bed, I want to say where the Obamas stayed or something. Because while he rubbed his hands gleefully or something, and that the whole thing was filmed by Putin. And then Putin called him up and said, okay, now you do as I say or I'm releasing the P tape.
Yeah.
It was the dumbest goddamn thing on earth, I know. Yeah. But it was, I mean, kompromat is taking, you know, a mix of truth and lies or believable lies and using it to smear somebody. And a lot of people wanted to believe, people deeply believed that, deeply, and spent years trying to prove it. And even after it was debunked, people refused to disbelieve in it. They wanted to believe that so badly. It was a very effective piece of kompromat, and how it was rolled out to the public was very effective as well.
Yeah, but of course, the corollary of that is that Trump and the people around him are vindictive beyond even the norms of a very vindictive polity, which we are now. And they will never, ever forgive that or forget it.
Exactly. So the first big scandal that could be, you know, placed under what becomes Russiagate, it breaks out in August of 2016. And I have to say, my reporting played a role in this, against my wishes, because I was out there trying to say, you're warping what I wrote about. What I wrote about in 2008 for The Nation, I did this big article. It took me a long time to work on it. about how McCain's campaign manager, John McCain, the very anti-Russian John McCain. Now, if you remember back then in 2008 and even 2012, the Republicans were very, McCain and Romney, very anti-Putin, very anti-Russia, accused Obama of being soft on Russia, of being, you know, played like a fiddle by Putin, an appeaser. So what I wrote about was how his campaign manager, Rick Davis, is McCain's campaign manager, he ran a firm, Manafort Davis. Manafort is Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort, these are old Republican operatives, sleazeballs. They also worked with Roger Stone. And while Davis was managing McCain's campaign, his partner Manafort was working with Oleg Deripaska, who's very close to the Kremlin, one of the oligarchs in Russia, an aluminum magnate. And actually, Deripaska paid Manafort Davis money to arrange a meeting with McCain a couple of years, like in 2005 or six, to ask McCain to help him get his visa restored. And the point of my article, and I went into the different ways that Manafort was working with both, you know, Kremlin-aligned oligarchs and Kremlin, you know, Kremlin-friendly politicians like Yanukovych. But my point wasn't that, therefore, John McCain is actually, you know, Putin has a P-tape on him and John McCain is a puppet of Putin. My point was that they're lying, hypocritical scum. But people took it in a different direction, the same reporting, to say, oh, wait, actually, because Manafort now is Trump's campaign manager, that means Manafort, that Trump's campaign is actually being run by Putin. And that was starting to pick up steam in the summer of 2016. And then in August of 2016, as they were heading into like the big final stretch after the conventions for the election between Hillary Clinton and Trump, this advisor, an advisor to the Ukrainian president, Serhiy Lyshenko, who was like an anti-corruption crusader, but he's very corrupt himself, I'll explain why. He went public. He published in Ukrainska Pravda what he said were the black ledgers, the off-book ledgers from Yanukovych, the pro-Russian president, or so-called pro-Russian president who had to flee in 2014. Off-book ledgers showing that Paul Manafort was paid secretly by Yanukovych $12 million. Now, these numbers were probably manipulated. They didn't mean what they said, but it looked really bad, nevertheless. These were published initially in Ukrainska Pravda, USAID funded. It created a huge shitstorm, and it led to Manafort having to resign as the campaign manager for Trump. You know, this is just a couple months before the actual election. And everybody cheered, that's it, Trump's done. And I'm just going to read a little bit here from the headlines here. This is from the Financial Times in late August 2016. The headline, Ukraine's leaders campaign against, quote, pro-Putin, unquote, Trump. So you can start to see where the problems are coming here. I'll quote a little bit from here. For years, Serhiy Lyshenko, a top Ukrainian anti-corruption campaigner, worked to expose kleptocracy. Now he's focusing on a new perceived pro-Russian threat to Ukraine, U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump. The prospect of Mr. Trump becoming leader of the country's biggest ally spurred not just Mr. Lyshenko, but Kyiv's wider political leadership to do something they would never have attempted before, intervene, however indirectly, in a U.S. election. You know, and he talks about how everybody there supported opposed Trump, everybody in Kyiv opposed Trump and supported Hillary Clinton. So Trump's first major problem is out of Ukraine. He lost his campaign manager, and eventually Manafort was jailed, I think, for perjury. He didn't get jailed for any kind of collusion with Russia, although that's how people remember it.
With regard to what we were talking about before, as far as Ukraine's elite needlessly alienating Trump. It sounds now that they cast their lot with the DNC, basically, against Trump long ago.
Yes. It seemed like a smart bet. I mean, the whole American establishment, nobody thought Trump was going to win, right? I didn't think Trump was going to win in 2016. It looked like some weird blip that took place because the Republican Party had sort of, you know, lost control of shit. But that would all be put back together and the whole status quo would be put back together. It was such a, it was, you know, now looking back, we can see a whole series of these things like Brexit referendum that nobody expected. Everybody expected the status quo to remain. It just, they didn't have a, they didn't have experience or an ability to grasp the possibility that the status quo was broken and actually could not be put back together. You know, Humpty Dumpty can't be put back together. But, you know, Lord, they tried. Siri Leshenko, this same guy, by the way, is today, currently, an advisor to Zelensky. And, you know, this is the guy who he pranced to all the media. He was the hero. And, you know, here he is still working for Zelensky. Like, that's not a guy if you want your patron to keep giving you money. So if, you know, if you're Zelensky and you want to get on good terms with the new old president, Trump, probably the very last guy you want associated with you is Siri Leshenko. But there he is. And the reason Leshenko is there is because he is a major go-between between kind of the centrist Washington and Brussels kind of establishment and Ukraine. In the anti-corruption world, he's kind of like what Chubais was for the kind of IMF world. He's a really big deal. He's made great contacts. The other thing about Leshenko that's, you know, needs to be pointed out here is that, you know, it emerged after the elections and everything. It emerged that somehow on his meager salary, he and his girlfriend, who's a DJ, and who would like film themselves going to Burning Man, that they were able to acquire two very expensive, you know, multi six-figure dollar apartments in central Kyiv, and not on his salary. And he claimed that his DJ was just that, his DJ girlfriend was that successful. But it turned out Leshenko had been bankrolled all along by a Ukrainian oligarch, Viktor Pinchuk. He was a big backer of Maidan, and he was very close to the Democrats and the DNC. Pinchuk, he not only bankrolled a lot of the Maidan revolution groups, but in the sort of the 2010s up through 2016, he was the single largest donor to the Clinton Foundation. So he's donating money to the Hillary Clinton campaign. He's bankrolling this guy that so he's in with the Clintons. He's bankrolling this guy that nearly sank Trump's candidacy. You know, and again, the head of Hillary's and the DNC's opposition research on Trump Russia was this woman, Alexandra Chalupa, who is a Ukrainian-American lobbyist, big-time activist from one of these families with the same kind of sketchy grandfather who, like, fled with the retreating Nazis as Chrystia Freeland. This was the person in charge of digging up dirt. So from the Trump world's point of view, Ukraine is as hostile a foreign country as you could possibly imagine.
Why is Zelensky, that is, you know, Zelensky has metonymy for whatever faction is running things. Why not offer him up and just say, sorry, Mr. Trump, we made a mistake. Here's this guy's head on a plate.
It's a great question, and my guess is that powerful people in Brussels and some oligarchs want him there. If he gets rid of Leshenko, Leshenko has a lot of contacts in the West, and he can make a lot of noise about corruption if he's not in the cabinet, if he's not in Bankova, in, you know, their version of the White House. He's an advisor to their
White House. Makes sense, because it's not just domestic American establishment that he's plugged into. I mean, it's very much a transatlantic one, and big parts of it are still in place.
Right. And, you know, we see from the Europeans and Kaya Kallas, who, again, is, you know, one of the most powerful EU officials right now. They have total contempt for Trump. So they wouldn't be like, oh, yeah, you should get rid of one of our favorite, you know, go-betweens because of Trump. It's more like Trump is a fool and he just needs to be, like, you know, put in his place. like, because, you know, the first time around, Trump's first presidency was very feckless.
Yep.
They didn't have their shit together. They were not prepared. And they were, he was, his presidency was very much hobbled and kneecapped a lot by Russiagate. I mean, that was the whole anti-Russia stuff. I mean, its purpose was to crush Trumpism and hopefully Bernieism too, but primarily Trump. Mm. So, you know, as I said, in 2019, Russiagate reached its peak, Russiagate being the conspiracy theory that Trump was being, that he was literally a puppet run by Putin. And this was pushed again by New York Times, Washington Post. There'd be these like spiderweb relationship maps that Jonathan Chiat would publish with faces in New York Magazine. Like, I've now strung it all together. The thing, you know, one of the wildest things, I remember him posting one of these big relationship maps between Russians and then to people who are connected to people who are connected to people who are connected to Trump at the very end of this map or in the very center of it. And the thing is, I knew all those names were in Chiat's map, and they're all Jews. Like, it was like something out of the 1920s, the most paranoid, like, you know, anti-Semitic. The Jews are running him, except that it's the Russians running him, and he's too stupid to know these were all Jews that he was talking about. I know. But anyway, so the Mueller report kind of tanked the hope or the idea that they were going to impeach Trump for being run by Russia and colluding with Russia. But in Ukraine, they found their new cause. And I should add again here, real quickly, I want to say this, because this ties in with USAID and stuff. As soon as Trump won, there was this explosion of grant money going to, fact-checking groups, disinformation groups, journalist organizations, and so on. And I don't know if you remember, like, I even had a sit down through somebody, a movie producer I knew, in New York in like early 2017, and he introduced me to Lowell Bergman, you know, from The Insider. From the movie The Insider, who was the head of UC Berkeley's journalism school, and somebody from Columbia. And they were kind of, they wanted to hear from me, like, do I think Russia is controlling Trump and what to look out for? And I just told them, like, this sounds crazy to me. No, I don't think so.
Were they unhappy to hear that?
Bergman wasn't. I really liked Bergman. He was nothing, again, he was nothing like the Al Pacino character, who I loved from The Insider, you know? Yeah. I remember you did a great imitation of Lowell Bergman. But oh, yeah. you remember that movie, The Insider, right?
With, right, the Russell whistleblower Crow. Guy.
Yeah, the tobacco whistleblower guy, yeah. And and then 60 Minutes ultimately sells him out because of profits and fear of lawsuits. Right. Anyway, that's the Lowell Bergman guy. He's actually in person a really nice guy and kind of soft-spoken and stuff. And they were just talking about, well, whatever the case, there is so much money and so many resources, unlike anything, being poured into the next Watergate. But it's already known in advance what the next Watergate is, which is proving that Trump is run by Russia. And a lot of this is USAID money going into all of these fact-checked, you know, why do they hate fact-checking, disinformation, OCCRP, all of these organizations? Because ultimately, they were all aimed at Trump, because the metropole is what matters most. You know, Putin as well, but Putin's a battlefield. Really at stopping Trumpism. You know, USAID money went into the German Marshall Fund, which then set up like the Hamilton 68 project, basically set up this project to fight disinformation that was headed up by Michael McFaul and Bill Kristol and some other, you know, and a former CIA chief or something. And they would, like, police disinformation. So anything that was not sufficiently pro-Ukraine or sufficiently pro-Hillary or pro-Democrat would be labeled disinformation and then could be censored. You know, and again, this, if you're wondering why they're cracking down on USAID, because they made USAID a weapon in a domestic battle on top of all the shitty things USAID has done overseas.
For a world that's supposed to be pretty cynical and able to pivot in a hurry, depending on which way the wind's blowing, a lot of people and institutions seem to have invested in a losing cause and kept investing in it, like tripling up on their bets for the DNC and the whole establishment behind it.
Yeah, they've just all convinced themselves we're sort of masters of the universe and we're good. And there's just no way that this can be real. We're going to find a way.
Right.
It's some kind of bug in the system. It's too much internet freedom. It's Russian disinformation. There's a bug. There are some deplorables out there. There's people, uneducated white men in farm country. You know, there's just some bug in the system that screwed it up, but we're going to fix it.
Well, actually, yeah, that makes sense because I've said I read a lot of comment sections, and there's this sort of mainstream Democratic view that, yeah, it's these dumb white males, which isn't quite true as far as I know.
Yeah.
And as if the fact that they were dumb white males somehow made them people that you could disregard completely, which is not the right way to think about it if you're trying to run a campaign. That's basically like running an advertising campaign.
And it's amazing, I know.
You can't just say that, like, oh, well, half of our audience is completely stupid. We will not bother to address completely stupid people.
Yeah. It's weird. That's what happens. Apparently, that's what happens when you have a higher education. You're susceptible to that kind of thinking. You know, it's the people with the highest pedigrees and credentials that seem to think that way. But as Matt Brunig pointed out, is this labor writer, labor sort of an economics writer, he pointed out that if you add it up, actually a majority of the votes for Trump come from the aggregate of women, Latino, Black, you know, LGBTQ, who voted for him. So, you know, white males or whatever are ultimately, if you just take that one, it's not the over 50% that pushed him over. I mean, it's, if you add up, because a lot of women, white women especially, but a lot of white women voted for Trump. And then you add in all the, you know, African-Americans, Latinos, so on, that actually pushes over the 50% of his support, which is a really funny, I don't know, I find that really funny. Funny
trolling,
but it's
true. Yeah, well, it's strange. Like, if you're actually running a campaign in a democracy where the person who gets more votes wins, then you can't afford to think that way.
It's really weird. I mean, I'm just going to point this out. People may not know it, but there are a lot of white males in this country. A lot of them. They're water skiing out here. And, you know, you go to certain parts of the country. If your country doesn't look the same everywhere you are, you know, it's a lot more multicultural and diverse in big cities, wealthy cities. A lot more diverse in wealthy coastal cities. It's a lot more divided, segregated in other parts like here. Very segregated.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, like whenever I try to look at American opinion, I slowly start to realize most people didn't grow up knowing any Asians, for example.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
They weren't around at that time, but
yeah.
They were in California, so.
Yeah. Yeah, so going back to 2019, another consequential year, 2019, a few things happened. One is sort of the Maidan uber nationalist regime that had been running things very badly since 2014. I was about to get voted out. There were presidential elections in Ukraine that year, and everybody knew that the winner was going to be this, you know, outsider comedian named Volodymyr Zelensky, who came from a Russian-speaking background, who's Jewish in a country known for its anti-Semitism, who, you know, did a lot of his comedy even in Russia, and who campaigned on bringing peace and ending the wars. And people were sick of the nationalism and the wars. They were so sick of it and the economic collapse, because Ukraine suffered enormous economic collapse after Maidan, partly from austerity imposed on them from the West and partly, of course, from the wars. So before Zelensky, before the election that the Maidan regime, I guess you'd call it, led by Petro Poroshenko, was out, they changed the constitution, because Ukraine's constitution that was passed in the mid-90s enshrined neutrality, military neutrality, that they were not to be a part of any alliance. And that was thought to be the smart move, and that once you get involved in trying to be one or the other's alliance, you're going to become the bloodlands again. That was enshrined. And that was something that rankled the West. Now, the West didn't want to bring them into NATO, but they wanted the Ukrainians to aspire to get into NATO to piss off the Russians and subvert the Russians, right? So so what they did was they changed the constitution just before Zelensky won with a 74% mandate, changed that constitution on several points in the constitution to basically mandate that it must be the strategic goal of the president and parliament and all officials to push Ukraine into NATO with as much as they can, that it is the strategic imperative. And that
so
was aimed.
It's like coyness as a policy, like we insist that you want us, but we're going to play coy with you when you do.
Yes. But at the same time, we funded so much of civil society and so much of the media and so many politicians that it's in what they, you know, now call the new nobility since the war started, in that whole grant feeder class. It's in their interest to keep that, to keep pushing that dream. And anybody who says we shouldn't go into NATO is denounced as a Russian traitor. And that had real consequences after 2014. So there was no room for any discussion or debate about it. The only possibility was to take the presidency, to elect somebody who would try and bring Ukraine back to being sort of more the multicultural Ukraine rather than the kind of ethno-nationalist Ukraine, and to bring peace with Russia through the Minsk Accords, which was a humiliating deal for Ukraine that they were forced to sign. But they did sign it, and among the terms of that were that they would eventually get back all their territory, but they would have to devolve local powers to the Donetsk region and reinstate Russian as a second official language and some of these other things, which they dragged their— Poroshenko signed it and then dragged his feet. So Zelensky wins, but as soon as he takes office, I talked about this in the USAID episode, all of these civil society organizations, it was more than 70, funded by USAID, funded by EU, some scary people involved, including Andrei Parubi, who was the co-founder of the Social National Party, this kind of neo-Nazi party, who then eventually became the speaker of the Ukrainian parliament. They sent an open letter to Zelensky and said, if you do anything to bring peace, if you do anything to implement those accords, there's going to be another Maidan revolution. Wow. And this was, so this is read as the U.S. saying this, you know, the U.S. and Brussels saying this through their satraps. So that happens. And so Zelensky is not really allowed to, he has no room to really move. Now, right at this time, it's like in July, so in the middle of July or August, I think, the summer of 2019, that's when the next big Trump scandal breaks out. And what happens is this. So Trump's looking towards the 2020 election, and he wants to dig up, he wants to get dirt. Since the Biden, well, the Hillary people got all their dirt on Trump from Ukraine, Trump knows, and the MAGA world knows, that there's some dirty Biden business in Ukraine, because Biden's son, Hunter, the famous Hunter Thompson, in 2014, right after the Maidan revolution, And when his dad was basically, you know, Biden as vice president was basically seconded as viceroy overseeing Ukraine by Obama. Hunter Biden magically gets hired by the largest natural gas company, Burisma, to be on their board of directors because he's such an expert, you know. it was labeled a ceremonial post. And for this ceremonial job, which was obviously to talk to his dad and to use his name and influence, he was paid $83,000 a month. This is in a country where the average salary...
I hadn't realized that. Wow. Yeah.
This is a crackhead. So they're basically paid $83,000 a month when the average Ukrainian salary was dropped after the Maidan Revolution was between $200 and $300 a month.
Oh, my God.
But Trump, of course, being super inept as he was then and using, you know, he relied on just goofballs like Rudy Giuliani. He very crudely tries to do what the DNC Hillary crowd does through more subtle means, through proper intermediaries, through, for all we know, CIA, right? As I said, CIA had been there since 2014. There's definitely a faction of the CIA that thought Trump was a threat. FBI had been there since 2014 through the Anti-Corruption Bureau. The FBI is involved in that. It's also where Sergei Lyshenko is involved. So Trump just basically sends Giuliani out there and then arranges a phone call with Zelensky and says to Zelensky, more or less, gee, I'd really like to, you know, release this next aid package to you. I've got something you want, and you've got something I want. Can you help me find out some stuff about the Biden family? And Zelensky, some of those calls were later released. You know, Zelensky was like, I felt really sorry for him then. I mean, he's a lot more hateable now, I guess, but he was kind of likable then. And he was just like, what in the fuck have I gotten myself into? What, you know, how do I get myself out of being a pawn in this factional brawl in like the Roman Empire?
Yeah, it just reminds me of what we were talking about last week, like the Northwest tribes,
yes.
Like they're trying to figure out what they can do. And it's just like, oh, I wish you'd all just go away and leave me alone, but that's not going to happen.
Yeah. And while this was turning from scandal to eventually impeachment, Sergei Lyshenko pops up again, current advisor to Zelensky. He was an advisor to Zelensky's campaign. He may have been an advisor to Zelensky at this exact time, although they changed their story on that. But he goes to the press because nobody has better access to Western reporters than Lyshenko. They all adore him. And he said, yeah, Zelensky, we've been trying to arrange a phone call with Trump ever since Zelensky took office. And they kept blowing us off. And they finally said, we'll talk to him if, we'll talk to Zelensky, Trump people, if he helps us dig up dirt, compromat on Biden. And he goes public with that. And that's a bombshell story. And then a day later, he walks it back and said, well, it may have not been exactly that, but people didn't pay attention to when he walked it back. And again, Lyshenko. So that led directly to the impeachment. The whistleblower, who was the main whistleblower? Alexander Vindman. He is an intelligence colonel. He was in the National Security Council. He is Ukrainian-American and a big fan of Ukraine. He was one of the people listening in on the call as, you know, different people listen in on calls, high-level calls to record them or for whatever reasons. And then he filed a whistleblower complaint and then came out as like the hero of the first impeachment. He was the hero.
Yeah, I can see this now. I can see a lot better than I had before, that a lot of people believed in the power of the remaining DC establishment to force what they considered a morally correct conclusion, as when MacArthur got slapped down or McCarthy got slapped down.
Mm, that right.
The way they saw it, the righteousness of the upper management in D.C. would necessarily triumph. Yeah, I can see that.
So they impeached him for basically trying to coerce a foreign leader to interfere in the 2020 election. And, you know, the first impeachment was, if you hated Trump, you didn't care how kind of flimsy or bogus this impeachment was. You were just, you wanted him freaking impeached. The problem is, and it worked, you know, and then there were all these grandstanding speeches by Adam Schiff and others that, you know, the reason Trump is undermining Ukraine, but Ukraine is protecting America and our freedom.
Yeah.
If we don't help Ukraine fight Russia over there, Russia will be fighting us here on our soil. And this is what Trump is helping his friend, Vladimir Putin, et cetera, right? So you can imagine an already vindictive man, you know, educated by Roy Cohn. What his feelings on Ukraine.
Yeah, and he comes back and it's like, why is he so mad?
Exactly. Yes. But, you know, it has to be said, too, that doing all of this, Russiagating, basically like psyopsing the entire population, or certainly half the population, through outlets that had been a bit more careful and responsible about an absolute crazy conspiracy theory that, you know, the president is literally controlled through a P-tape by the Kremlin. The damage that the establishment, which was already having problems and already breaking, the damage it did to itself in the service of trying to reassert itself, all that is the blowback we're dealing with now. The bogus impeachment, like, yeah, to the center left, probably a lot of the left, it's like, fine, get him impeached. But you have broken, you have helped polarize the country. You know, you have helped ultimately make MAGA deeper and bigger. They all remember this. It's, you know, we have to remind ourselves of this because in our spaces, we don't go over this over and over as a grievance.
Yeah.
But we need to know why.
Every time when you look at the comment sections, it's, oh yeah, Russiagate?
Yeah.
How did that work out?
Yep. I mean, on January 6, 2021, everybody was yelling about Russiagate, you know? Mm-hmm. And I remember bringing that up to people and they're like, wait, what? No, you're making that up. That's just because you're obsessed with Russia.
Yeah.
Like they don't even know that that's a grievance, you know? And when they hear it, it doesn't really connect. So getting back to Zelensky, in 2020, you know, Trump is impeached, but he stays in office. And Zelensky attempts to do a peace deal to try to bring a settlement with Russia, fails. He actually has a meeting, kind of a summit with Putin in late 2019. But he's also like openly attacked. I think he goes and visits the front lines and they're like right sector and Azov guys who basically threaten to murder him. And he realizes, I think at this point, that having 75% of the population behind you is not power. It wins elections. Mm. But in a country that is, there's so much enemy and so little connection between, I don't know, the political class and the people, that power lies with the securocrats and the grant feeders who are funded by power lies with the West, the securocrats, and the oligarchs.
It's sort of like a highly funded grant-based polity with a backup which consists of people who were a lot like the Japanese fascists in the 1930s in that they will flat out kill you if you decide to make peace before they're ready to.
Yeah.
So it's a strange mixture.
Yeah, you can see the many uses of these Azov battalions and right sectors. Oligarchs use them for initially for raids and takeovers, hostile takeovers, like in the very literal sense of the word, of rival businesses. Police would use them to sic them on whoever they wanted to sic them on. But also with the liberal class, the liberal grant feeder class, has always been very closely aligned with them. They're sort of the muscle. The Azov people don't love the Western-backed grant feeders. But the Azov people know that that is their connection to the West and NATO, and that's the only way to defeat Russia. So they're in that kind of alliance.
Right.
And the liberals worship them as mensch, as real men, because the liberal grant feeder class won't go to fight.
Yeah, that's a familiar reflex.
Like, yes.
Oh, those guys in the trenches, grimy, hard-nosed, granite-chinned.
Yeah. So what happens in 2020 is that as the year goes on and, you know, the U.S. is having its elections, COVID, Zelensky's ratings collapse. By the time Biden wins the election, November, December of 2020, Zelensky's party rating is below that of the kind of more avowedly pro-Russian opposition party. So you're back to that again. The Party of Regions, which is led by Viktor Medvedchuk, who supposedly is the godfather of one of Putin's daughters, or Putin is the godfather of one of his daughters. There are connections there, probably business and political connections, and perhaps personal connections with Medvedchuk. His party now, at the end of 2020, ranks the number one party in the country because Zelensky failed. So Zelensky's like, so Zelensky sees who wins. Biden's people immediately feel him out because Biden's people think that Trump has done so much damage to American prestige that we need to go back and show the world we're number one. America is back. That was the motto. The adults are back in the room. And it was again going to be through Ukraine and Russia. And so, and Zelensky was all ears because his ratings were in free fall. And so the deal they kind of worked out was this. Biden and Blinken and Jake Sullivan encouraged Zelensky to flip and become even more hawkish than Poroshenko was, to go even further, because Russia needs to be taught a lesson. And we need to show them that, you know, you can't be pushed around and America's got your back. And if that involves cracking down on what they call pro-Russian, you know, disinformation media, disinformation spreading politics, then we back you on that too, because we need to show that we mean business. We're going to try and bring back the status quo that we love so much. So literally within days of Biden's inauguration in late January 2021, and throughout the next weeks, Zelensky goes on this spree of a complete U-turn. He announces the banning of opposition, of the main opposition political parties, including the one that is now the number one rated party. He bans opposition media on the guise that these are all pro-Russian and they're all treasonous. And eventually these people are all like suspected of treason. The funny thing is he eventually charges Poroshenko, the other pro-Western president who came into power after Maidan, also charges him with treason because it's like, wait a minute, if I can get rid of my rivals this way, why not go after all my rivals?
Right.
And you know, so that gets kind of ugly. The U.S. publicly backs him on that, and then they issue new national security directives, making it a strategic imperative to retake Crimea and Donbass by force and to gear all Ukrainian resources towards retaking it, that if Russia doesn't give in quickly, you know, basically screw the Minsk agreements, we're going to retake it by force. So within weeks of that, and then the Atlantic Council comes out, it's pretty clear the Atlantic Council had a big role in shaping this, and they came out with their big sort of white paper on what Ukraine's policies should be that aligned nicely with Biden and Zelensky policies. And within a couple weeks of that, Russia and Putin start moving troops to the border and start talking about, you know, there's going to be a serious response to this and we're not going to take this anymore. So what happens when the war actually does break out in February 2022? And, you know, we remember this clearly. Now, first of all, looking back again, we didn't believe the invasion would happen, and neither did most of the Russia experts I like, and most of even world leaders believe that Russia would actually invade, in part because in the 2014-15 war, Russia was very cautious about Donbass. They did get involved in two major battles, the Baltseve and Ilovaisk, which were kind of crushing turning points for Ukraine in those early battles, but that was mostly civil war. And, you know, it was a miscalculation on all of our parts, but what we thought, at least, and what a lot of people thought was, it's so obvious that the Biden administration and NATO are trying, and the Atlantic Council are trying to goad Russia into doing something suicidal. Putin can't be that stupid.
And, it was like, you know, there's one of those cool Carlito books where Carlito whacks a couple of guys himself, and his friends say, "Man, there must have been a dozen ways to cook that goose. You had to go out and do it yourself in front of witnesses."
Yeah. And, you know, I remember the way we kind of made sense of the invasion initially, that it was a message to the West. I mean, it was. It was like, it was a flipping of the table, but it was also like a controlled, it was like, we're going to take out this uppity rival's kind of proxy as a message to that powerful rival. And, you know, of course, the war and initially didn't go the right way, and through the first 6 months didn't go the way they expected. I mean, I think it's pretty clear looking back that Putin thought the sort of the shock and awe of it, that first initially they surround Kyiv and it would scare Zelensky's people into, like, fleeing to maybe Lvov. And that would have been a huge win for the Russians from there. Then they could have presumably taken Kyiv. That didn't happen. Then, you know, the war expanded and Russia took all this territory. And even though they were doing poorly, they did sit down immediately for sort of ceasefire peace deal talks in Istanbul. And a lot has come out since then about how the Ukrainians, the Russians, they actually came to an understanding, to a deal. And it was going to be sort of Russia would return back to where the borders were before the invasion. And Ukraine would declare neutrality and they would, I don't know, have some more respect for, you know, Russian language rights. And that's when Boris Jordan flew in with a message from Biden, we can get a better deal, which was the whole impetus for ramping up in 2021. We can scare the Russians and get a better deal than Minsk. And, you know, so now here we are. But what I wanted to say is when this war first started, if you remember, John, the way it was framed by Biden and the Democrats especially, and then also the media, the George Packers, the liberal interventionists, was our glorious purpose, which we had in the 1990s and we had in the early 2000s before things went awry, is back. We are the good guys. We have a purpose. Yes. The American dream of like the Pax, like we're the good guys again. This is the greatest war, you know, this is the greatest cause and the greatest war. And for Biden, it was like, this is great because it's going to unite everybody, including all the quote unquote good Republicans, and split off, you know, this will bury MAGA basically. Because
they were truly astonished when that national rally didn't quite happen. I mean, people were tired. People were tired of foreign wars that never seemed to go anywhere and machinations by agencies that had an agenda that seemed to stretch way, way back into the Cold War. They thought they got out of that era, but they never did. I mean, the people who were running things seemed to yearn for it. There was a real 20th century nostalgia that that motivated the Biden administration to the point that they gave up on a lot of things. They gave up when you saw the contrast with Trump coming in. You saw how much they just gave up on their domestic agenda.
Yeah.
But when it came to their foreign intervention, humanitarian intervention, supposedly, agenda, they had tremendous confidence. That was what they most seemed to want. And unfortunately, it even carried over into some strange confidence about giving Israel 2,000-pound bombs to blow up every house they felt like.
Yeah.
And then they, you know, they carried that over too. And that I think was a much bigger mistake than they realized at the time.
Yes.
Or that any American journal realized at the time.
People have to understand that the status quo and the assumptions we're used to don't hold anymore. Yeah. And whoever grasps that and uses that, you know, is going to win. And those who don't get it are getting picked off. And so, you know, so this war initially, and I'll be close to wrapping this up, by the way. This war, I think, you know, it did rally a lot of people. It did sort of unify, because it was a shock when Putin first invaded. It was a shock. And in the first month, let's say, you know, it wasn't just liberals, although it was primarily liberals. It was a lot of people who were supportive of Ukraine because it was the invaded underdog. But it didn't take long for the new dynamic to reassert itself. The war became very much identified with the Democrats. Nancy Pelosi famously came out publicly and said, because it coincided with the explosion in inflation in 2022. And there was some linkage to it because, of course, you know, fuel prices soared. And Pelosi, I think it was, came out publicly and said, people should be willing to pay a little more to defend freedom, you know. And like, who's, you know, this is from the richest person in Congress.
Yeah.
So these things over time.
Yeah, there's always a faint echo of World War II, even.
Yes.
In whatever they say, because they're really ancient and it shows.
Yeah. You know, in time, the war became very deeply identified with the Democrats, and the success of the war became identified with the success of the establishment. And so at the same time, the critics, anybody critical of the war, anybody not on board, anybody who started, you know, the MAGA world. Now, I'm not MAGA world, but I'm just saying why it happened this way. Like, it's pretty easy to see it. People with, you know, Black Lives Matter signs on their lawns, and this is what I saw here, then put out Ukraine flags. Like, this did very quickly become a partisan war effort that was trying to be sold as a universal war effort. And there was not a lot of space allowed to air out how actually a lot of people on the right didn't see it that way. And when the Republicans came back into power in 2023, in the House at least, you know, they had to start answering to their base. And so you saw aid started to be held up, and the Republican establishment still didn't really want to turn their backs on Ukraine, but MAGA sure as hell did, and resented when Mike Johnson would cave in as they saw it and approve massive aid packages that Biden wanted. They very resentfully took it and you know, waited for their chance for revenge. And I think the European centrist establishment, I think the war has served that the same function for them. Because in Europe, like, for example, in Germany, this kind of post-Nazi or sort of Nazi-flirting party, the AfD, the anti-immigrant party, they are really the only party who have staked out a pretty, like, their position, as far as I can see, is screw the Ukraine war, restart Nord Stream, because since we lost Nord Stream, our industry has collapsed because we don't have cheap Russian gas, and let's get our industry back in order again. And, you know, I think for the kind of the flagging establishment in Europe, they thought this war and the war cause, and briefly it did, would help shore up support for them and sort of rejuvenate people or get people to restore faith in the establishment. But actually, it started working the other way. I mean, in country after country, after February 2022, and especially as the war started getting worse, you started seeing parties from these sort of post-fascist, Nazi-adjacent parties working their way into ruling coalitions or running governments. One after another, and you can't delink that from, you know, from the war. This happened in Italy, it happened in Sweden, it happened in Finland, and go on and on. So, you know, that the so-called populist, neo-populist right in Europe also has seen all of these fact-check, internet censorship programs funded through civil society by USAID and versions of USAID that it's targeted supposedly at Russian disinformation, but it's always at them as well. They have the same grievances. So when you see Vance shocking everybody by, you know, scolding the Europeans for their censorship for what they did in Romania, which is true. They just annulled on totally, this has never happened in the EU as far as I know. They just, this election we talked about earlier in Romania where this kind of far-right nutter wound up coming way in first place. And then they just said, oh, that was, there was some Russian disinformation campaign on TikTok and they just annulled it. And the EU backed the annulment of that election. Vance was coming out saying how wrong that is. And it is wrong, and how wrong the censorship is. And it is wrong, and he basically in Munich defended the AFD, which really shocked the hell out of people. And people are like, why would an American leader want to support a party that is, let's say, soft on Germany's Nazi past? Like, that seems crazy and stupid and self-defeating. Well, no, I mean, another way of looking at it from MAGA's point of view and from Trump's point of view is that they've had the same enemies, and that actually Trump and MAGA's enemies are the people like Kaya Kallas and von der Leyen,
yeah,
and the European establishment and the USAID-backed groups that have constantly tried to, you know, bring them down.
Yeah, people who overestimate their own competence above all, who think of themselves as a true elite, but can't think of any better way of achieving their goals than to start a war, which is proverbially the most uncertain thing in the world and the most dangerous way of trying to retain power. I mean, you would have to think that these are kind of jumped up Tracy Flicks who mm-hmm. are in way over their heads and have proven out there in the world to be wrong. And why should you listen to them anymore?
And I got to say, you know, NAFO, I mean, it's not a, it is a lot of people's lived experience of the Ukraine war, people in the West who obviously never actually went into trenches, but social media tricks your brain, well, it, you know, and really is into feeling like you're in immediate conversations and that if you're being mobbed or smeared or swarmed, it feels like being bullied in a very visceral way. And, you know, the like Elbridge Colby, for example, who's this controversial pick to be under defense secretaries, I assume is going to make it. The Israel lobby and the neocons are going ballistic because he's not a pro-interventionist guy. But, you know, just last year or year before when he was, because he's been, as a realist, he's from the realist wing. I don't know how MAGA he is, but he's definitely kind of in a let's not be over-interventionist realist wing of the party. Conservative realist, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying. War is dangerous. War
yes.
is just, you're rolling a lot of dice there and you're betting a lot.
And he got swarmed by NAFO when he was not in the administration, but was like, you know, writing in Foreign Policy magazine, whatever. And I saw him even complain. It was enough that he even complained about it. And he's like, because NAFO's job is to shut down, not even to shut down anybody who is at all not with the program, the pro-war, mm-hmm. pro-Ukraine war program, and to scare anybody else from speaking up publicly and possibly influencing it, to make sure there's no dialogue whatsoever.
Yeah, that's why they do this very new style of exaggerated rhetoric, which
yes.
is like, we don't have any rules. We're
yes.
going to stomp you, and then we're going to crush your corpse, and it doesn't matter, and then we're going to smirk.
Yeah.
it's meant to be overkill.
Yes. And in your replies, you know, they swarm the replies and it pisses you off and it makes you wonder if other people are now turning against you too. And it makes other people scared to come out in support of you. So Colby himself said, you know, this is really interesting. I wonder how much NATO or American intelligence and American sort of, you know, arms of American State Department are involved in funding this as a psychological warfare operation. So you have, and he's not the only one thinking that. Other people who are now in the Trump administration are already looking into that. And as I said, NAFO has quieted down enormously this year. You know, these guys, I mean, they were too effective in a way. They've done themselves a lot of harm, but the thought was, you know, Trump was a blip and Biden came to power, and even if Biden himself is a dotard, nevertheless, the what he represents is the massive power, and they've learned their lesson about how to keep this blip out of power, and it's never going to happen again. So the war is a proxy war, not just that Ukraine is a proxy for, you know, for the American empire to weaken or kneecap its rival in Russia, but as a lot of wars are in the metropolis, it's also a proxy war between factions of power.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
And that is why Trump, as the other faction, the faction that the Ukraine war cause was meant to crush, is so hostile to the Ukraine cause.
I think that's a really good point, and I think you explained it really well.
So here we are, year three of the war, and, you know, it's hard to imagine how the Ukraine war cause rescues itself, because Zelensky is, from what I have heard from some people in the know, you know, his main advisors are, his strategic comms advisors anyway, are like people from Norm Coleman's firm and I know that guy, and like some Never Trumpers
who got demolished,
yes,
like by, what was it, Galloway? I mean,
oh yeah. And some sort of Never Trumpers. I mean, the thing, the Zelensky people don't, and the same with the European, the EU kind of political class, they don't know how, put it this way, they do not know how to talk to or understand where MAGA is coming from, except as a boil caused by Russian disinformation. They don't even have a possibility of grasping it. And so, yeah.
No, and yet, if they'd watched the debates, that was the moment where it was clear that, you know, you can try to control things in many different ways, but when you shove a dotard up to the podium and he barely knows where he is or how to finish a phrase, and Trump openly mocks him, he doesn't even do his really aggressive stuff, he just says, I don't know what this guy is talking about, then what do you expect?
Yeah. Everyone, it has to be repeated, everyone who insisted that Biden should stay in the race in 2022-23, who lied about how bad he was and who kept lying right up till that moment, rather, and said having a primary is bad and will only help Trump, those were Trump's best allies. They were the greatest allies Trump 24 and MAGA could have possibly had. That election was all yours, baby. So here we are, and you know, Ukraine is going to be the victim of this. I mean, it already has been a victim all along. One thing I didn't point out, this EU agreement that Yanukovych in 2013 finally turned down, and that sparked the Maidan, the whole protest and movement. This EU agreement in 2013 was a lot like NATO in a sense that the EU wanted Yanukovych and Ukraine to sign a really terrible deal. It was like 100,000 pages long, and it made all kinds of demands on Ukraine. Basically, Ukraine would have to open up all of its markets to the EU for their products and for investment and to be able to buy stuff. But the EU wouldn't have to open its markets to cheap Ukrainian goods. And Ukraine would also have to cut a lot of their ties with Russia, which was by far their biggest trading partner. And it would have to put itself under the foreign policy and security apparatus of the EU, which is obviously anti-Russian. And Russia, on the other hand, offered like $15 billion of incentives. And if Ukraine signed it, they were never going to get into the actual EU anyway. Mm-hmm. It was more like a roadmap to get in, you know, the road to the EU agreement, which was bad for Ukraine and great for the EU. But if Ukraine actually got in the EU, it would be disastrous for the EU. They'd have to pay up the ass. It would destabilize the EU. So Ukraine would have never got into the EU, but the whole revolution was about Ukraine signing a bad deal so that they could have the promise of being in the EU. Ukraine is never going to get into NATO, but they're on the road to the forever road to NATO. And they have all these people, you know, a powerful class whose interest is to keep the political class invested in chasing a dream that will never happen, because to not chase that dream is treason. I mean, the whole thing is madness. It's absolute madness. And Ukraine is the victim of it. And I know a lot of Ukrainians, you know, Ukrainian voices are supposed to be just one voice that is, you know, pro-war effort. And it's just not true. I know we've had some on our program. I know a lot of Ukrainians who are so angry about all of this. And I read through events in Ukraine how many Ukrainians are angry and feel profoundly betrayed. And they're getting betrayed even more now under Trump. And they've been betrayed by everybody in the West and their leaders. And it's just, it's awful. It's just awful all around.
I say, you know, like, let's send someone to Beijing. See what they can do.
Yeah,
make a deal. But anyway, that happy dream note.
Yeah, on that happy dream note, we can wrap it up. But I think before we end, I just want to make sure I make one point. I actually made this on social media as well. But, you know, when Vance made that big speech about censorship in Europe, he's right that there is censorship claiming to be targeted at Russian disinformation, which is really targeted at domestic undesirables, these so-called, you know, the right-wing neo-populists and stuff, as we talked about. But one thing Vance left out is the censorship, the really fierce censorship that Europe and the Trump administration have waged against the pro-Palestine movement. You know, again, former Radio Warner guest Ali Abu Nima was just arrested for having pro-Palestine views when he touched down in Switzerland. I mean, Trump just issued an executive order basically criminalizing, you know, too much criticism of Israel based on that wild definition of what anti-Semitism is. So they're both censoring. It's not the principle of censorship, although that's what they're pitching it as. It's censorship against my crowd and, you know, my faction. And he's half right about that, but unprincipled. So just wanted to make that point. But anyway, everything's awful. Welcome to 2025. I think we can end it here. Thanks, John. Thanks, Brennan.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.